There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This week, we're discussing reshuffles, Scotland, and whether or not John Bercow is going to get his seat in the House of Lords. Spoiler alert, no, he isn't. But we'll come on to that shortly. A couple of things I've got to tell you about first. The Times is running a series of masterclasses via Times Plus. The first is called Making a Top Charting Podcast. Maybe I should go along to this. Richard Herring is running it over the weekend of February the 29th to March the 1st. If you want to get tickets to it, go to mytimesplus.co.uk to book your place, and you may find me and producer Alex sitting in the audience taking notes. I'd also like to say a special hello to Becky in the Emirates, who posted a review on iTunes saying, without a weekly dose of Matt Chorley and Friends, I would feel every inch of the 4,354 miles that lie between my decade-long home in Abu Dhabi and the Westminster bubble. The final bong of Brexit happened to mark my 10-year anniversary as an expat. So, and she thought that was a momentous enough occasion to warrant making her first ever podcast review. I won't go on to repeat the nice things she said about us, but if you want to post a review on iTunes, it will actually help us up slightly up the charts, which would mean that we didn't need to go to the Richard Herring thing. So please do that on iTunes if you can. Right, down to the podcast this week. Delighted to be joined by James Starkey, an escapee from the government, a former special advisor, most recently at the Home Office to Priti Patel. He'll discuss what Boris Johnson should do with the reshuffle and why he should possibly think small. Kieran Andrews is the Scottish political editor of The Times. He'll try and explain what on earth is going on with Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP. Plus, Esther Webber, Red Box reporter, is here to totally predictably talk about what's happening in the House of Lords, which is Esther's favourite pet subject, and nobody knows more about it than she does. But let's kick off with what is going to be happening later this week, the reshuffle, and this is James Starkey.
The Prime Minister doesn't need to make big changes in his forthcoming reshuffle. Whether it's my former boss Priti Patel in the Home Office, my other former boss Dominic Raab in the FCO, or my other former boss Michael Gove in the Cabinet Office, many ministers are working effectively and helping the Prime Minister to deliver on his stonking majority. This is more about keyhole surgery, fine-tuning. Don't forget, it's the Prime Minister that put in place the current Cabinet just 6 months ago.
This is one of the weird things about this reshuffle, is that everyone, it's been talked up at various points as being very dramatic, but he chose all these people himself. It's not like he inherited, you know, a mixed bag and he finally wants to clear it out.
No, exactly. And if you remember, all of us in various ways would have been close to it. It was quite a dramatic...
It was pretty brutal.
...reshuffle in itself at the time. It wasn't I've just taken over, I'm going to make a couple of changes. You saw wide-ranging changes across the whole Cabinet. So it's very much his cabinet, I would argue. And I think whether you look at Grant Shapps in transport, Robert Jenrick, I think, is doing amazing work at MHCLG, that I think there's a range of ministers that are actually really quietly delivering. And we know from some of the briefing that that's what Downing Street wants.
The big difference between when he picked his cabinet in July was that Dom Cummings wasn't involved in that. because he sort of came in around the same time. And quite a lot of the talk around this reshuffle has been, you know, that Dom wants fewer people attending cabinet. He wanted to only have six people each running a super department or whatever, and ministers shouldn't go on the TV and the radio and all that. You've worked with Dom. What part do you think he is playing in this?
Well, I would say, one, having worked with Dom, and you read the things in the paper about him, is there's a lot of stuff that gets written by a certain advisor, which is not necessarily true. You know, people have a view of his personality. I worked with him. He was fantastic to work for on Vote Leave. And you'll know, speaking to people, people that worked with him will run through a big wall for him. I take with a pinch of salt a lot of the stuff that I read. I think what they want to make sure is that the ministers are out there delivering, not spending too much time worrying about their media. And so perhaps some of this, perhaps, is a kind of shot across the bow. You know, this is the kind of thing we'd be looking at in future. Here's the reshuffle. Let's see how dramatic it is. Like I said, I don't think he needs to make massive changes.
Do you think it would have been better if the idea it was going to be dramatic hadn't got going sort of after the election in December? There was a lot of talk about a massive clear out and cutting the numbers and, you know, the list of half a dozen, almost all women who are going to get the chop. If that doesn't end up happening, does he end up looking like he's bottled it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'll say this, having been in department at the time some of this was coming out and spoken to other special advisors and ministers, he's probably got a few more hours work out of them since those briefings came. So, it depends. If you worry about the cosmetics of it, maybe you could make that argument. But I think if you're basically your focus is underlying performance, then you could argue that that had the desired effect.
So do you think this was all like a performance enhancement drive?
Well, all I'm saying
it would work in most workplaces. Yeah. If it basically said, if you're not careful, we're going to sack you in February.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That would get you. Maybe I should try that with you, Esther.
Yeah, try it.
Kieran, what do you make of this? Because the reshuffle sort of come and go. They always get talked up and they're rarely as dramatic as we expect. And most people are not paying that much attention.
Well, I got caught a wee bit on the hop with the last reshuffle where we were all briefed pretty extensively that David Mundell was safe. So I clocked off for the day. I'd gone to meet a friend. I was sitting in a pub in outside of work hours, and suddenly the phone goes, running back home to grab the laptop. Reshuffles.
And try to work out who Alistair Jack was.
Well, there was a funny thing about Alistair Jack in that he doesn't really fit with the idea of Ruth Davidson's Scottish Conservative Party, in that, you know, he is essentially, if you want to boil it down to, you know, how you could characterise him from an opponent's point of view, he is your quintessential hunting, shooting toff. And he has ended up here as a Brexiteer, very much a Boris Johnson from, you know, what you said, okay, Dominic Cummings man, head down, get the job done, but not a great media performer, not someone who goes out and makes himself known. So there was a wee bit of shock, not just amongst the journalists, but also amongst a lot of the Scottish Conservatives who perhaps were doing a bit of Googling and didn't quite like what they found.
I remember actually getting a heads up about that from another Scottish Tory in Parliament and thinking, oh my God, can this be true? And I spelt his name wrong because I'd never written it before.
The other thing, though, I do wonder what you're saying about doesn't need to be a dramatic reshuffle, it's all about getting your head down and working. Is briefing for months in advance that you're going to have a big reshuffle because people aren't doing their job a good example of getting your head down and working and not ending up in the media from whoever's briefing out from Downing Street?
Well, I mean, number one, I don't think you guys might disagree, but that doesn't actually take up that much of your time. And there are people that are doing those specific jobs to deal with the media. So as a strategy, I don't think it necessarily negates it. To be honest, if you look at number 10, it's quite obvious, anyone that's been close to it, they have been doing a hell of an amount of work, even during the election period. You know, there was no complacency, but it was obvious to me, talking to people who either were still in number 10 or the ones, or like Dom, who was kind of outside of it, but not fully on the campaign, that there was a lot of work going on in terms of looking at what they were going to do. The announcement today about HS2, for example.
What's it like when you are on the inside as a special advisor in the run-up to a reshuffle? Because like you said, you've worked with several different ministers. What's going on? how much do you know about what your boss is or isn't doing? Because obviously there is a point when they go into Downing Street, sure, and presumably you're not there.
No, you're not there. I mean, it does remind me, I don't know how many of your listeners will have watched it or remember it, there's a great episode of Yes Minister, which I think is the most accurate programme about working in a department, in my view, when they're looking at the region, finding out about in the newspaper. Today it's about looking at Twitter. You know nothing. You have no idea. Even the secretaries of state don't know anything. No, there's like, I don't know, four or five people that know what's going on. Otherwise, it's just rumour. You're trying to work out which bits are potentially from the centre, so might have a grain of truth. But, you know, I spoke to people in government this morning. They're still, you know, they're saying, well, we think this person and this person might go, but we don't know.
Go on then, what are you hearing this morning? What's your latest intelligence from inside the machine?
Well, there's a view that we might have a new business secretary.
So Andrew Leadsom is not.
These are all very much rumours, and ditto perhaps with the Attorney General. But that's, as you know, been flying around for some time. But the wider view was just that there won't be particularly big changes. You know, we know we need a new culture secretary. So Prime Minister has a cabinet post to give away, if you like. But other than that, I think the top posts, Home Second Chancellor, very, very likely to stay the same.
And from a special advisor's point of view, which is the most fun department to be in? Because the Home Office strikes me as quite frightening.
It is frightening. I mean, it's incredibly hectic. As we've seen over the last 24 hours, it would have been very stressful to deal with, I can only imagine, for people in the department. I've always thought, and I've never been in it, I mean, I loved working in DEFRA personally, and the view would be, that's a smaller department, Michael was amazing to work for, and just see up close how he works. And I still stay in touch with many of the civil servants that I worked with because they were just so great to work with. Having read Damien McBride's fantastic book, Treasury seems like a great place. You don't have the it seems like you don't have to answer everything of as you do number 10. And so I have worked for people where one of the rumours is you might end up at Treasury. It never happened. You start the day maybe going to the second highest office in the land. You typically end the day exactly where you started the day. So that these things are really true. But look, I mean, I loved both departments that I worked in. You know, it's a real privilege just to work in government in, you know, any aspect, in my view.
I always imagine DCMS must be quite good because you get to go to Commonwealth Games and whatever else.
It's definitely popular for the freebies.
Yeah, you can go to a lot of theatre shows and musicals and whatever.
Yeah, I believe so.
Award ceremonies.
Yeah, exactly. You get to go to the Brits rather than the NFU annual conference. Although
NFU annual conference is fantastic, by the way. I can really recommend it.
Well, as I covered many in the past, I would agree. And also, DEFRA always had the best nibbles.
It's very true.
Because it's always showing off the best ability. Well, Esther Kim, which departments would you like to be in?
I think of Bagsy DCMS.
You're not allowed to just say Scotland, Kieran.
No, although the Scotland office has the best office in Whitehall. Dover House is tremendous. Yeah. So because Nick Clegg muscled his way into taking a side room there when he was Deputy Prime Minister, where he had his rowing machine installed in there so he could look out over Horse Guards Parade. See, I'd quite fancy DCMS for the trips to the Brits as well, but if I can't be your junior minister there, Esther, you know what? Go for the Justice Department. Just, it might be stressful, but, you know, imagine the power you would have.
I've always thought, because there's been a lot of conversation with the Labour leadership contest and who does Keir Starmer have and who would, you know, who do you have as shadow chancellor, shadow chancellor, treasury, strikes. But I reckon I could have a go at most departments. Don't you...
It's confidence.
With the Treasury. I mean, like, I'd be no good, but with the Treasury, you do have to, like, understand the numbers, don't you?
Yeah.
And you do need to have had a favourite economist and to know your...
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult...
Ideally.
I mean, that is... Yeah, we'll wait and see who Keir Starmer ends up choosing. But so the Treasury strikes me as one that you really do need to be, you know, somebody who gets the economy in a way that you could go into education and read up on it and get up to speed quite quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a daunting ministry to go into, I can imagine. Like you said, it's, you know, there's a lot of technical detail. But, I mean, whilst I definitely take your point, I think you need to understand these issues. My learning from government would be you need to spend the time to know your area, whether that's definitely the Home Office, etc. But don't forget, in any department, you have thousands of dare I use the word, experts behind you, able to help you understand this stuff, provide briefings. I think when they do the, you know, Treasury, when they do the budget and so on, you have a political person and a civil servant who is who's an expert in that area. So of course you need to understand the policy area. I think that goes for anything. I spent a huge amount of time at DEFRA reading up on environmental issues, on farming issues, spending time speaking to people, ditto on immigration, which was my area at the Home Office, and some of the other areas that I covered. But you know, you do have, and you realise it when you come out of government, you do have incredible resources to lean on and really great people in terms in the civil service.
And actually sometimes some of the best media spads that we deal with are the ones who don't consider themselves to be experts. So we'll sit in a meeting and just say, sorry, what is this? Knowing that that's the question the journalist will ask. And it, quite often if they just say, look, I really don't know, but I know just the person to ask, that's just as good as them trying to pretend they're a great policy expert. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens by the end of the week and whether or not anyone other than Andrea Leadsom has had bad news. We'll see how that pans out. Reshuffle expect, we think, on Thursday. Let's go north of the border, though. Kieran is down in London, paying a morale-boosting visit to the Times building. Let's take a look at what's happening with the SNP. This is Kieran Alges.
A health service under a cloud of problem-hit hospitals and missed waiting times targets, an education system that's been reviewed by the OECD, and a finance secretary who was forced to resign hours before he was due to deliver his budget after he was caught bombarding a schoolboy with messages. After almost 13 years in government, is the SNP finally falling apart? Probably not.
Kieran, I can't think you're just talking Scotland down. any criticism of the SNP is obviously a huge slight on Scotland. I mean, from our, you know, hundreds of miles away viewpoint, it does seem as if a whole load of things are coming together to be, you know, create this sort of perfect storm of bad news, the SNP. But then we did think that intermittently last year and the year before, and then they win more seats in the election and...
The SNP, like I said, has been in government for 13 years. And like any government who's been in power for that long, their record is starting to catch up with them. You know, the issues around the health service and the education sector are not new. These have been dogging the SNP for a while, but they're just starting to stick a little bit. And where the SNP has been almost completely Teflon coated previously, you can see somebody's taken a bit of a scourer to the side of it, and yet they're still polling 50%. The last three opinion polls that were done by three different companies, comfortably ahead of everyone else, which says something about the state of the opposition party in Scotland, that probably the biggest challenge to Nicola Sturgeon's authority has come from within her own ranks, with the likes of Joanna Cherry and Angus McNeill, her MPs down here, questioning her strategy on a second independence referendum.
And just explain for people who for some reason haven't been following that debate, what is the difference of opinion within the SNP?
Well, currently Nicola Sturgeon has requested the powers to hold a second referendum. The you know, powers over the constitution are reserved to Westminster. Boris Johnson is saying no. No chance, no referendum whilst I'm in power. Some in our party are suggesting that the Scottish Parliament should just pass a bill to hold a referendum anyway and let the UK government challenge that in court. Nicola Sturgeon's very wary of doing that, not least because of the example we saw in Catalonia and the, you know, the fallout from the referendum there. She says she wants to deliver independence, not just a referendum. And there's a bit of tension over basically how patient people are willing to be in the SNP.
What were the side of Joanna Cherry and Angus McNeill? What do they want?
So Joanna Cherry has been, she's walked quite a fine line on it. She's the SNP's Home Affairs spokeswoman at Westminster and is seen as a potential successor to Nicola Sturgeon. She has really been pushing the idea of laying down a bill in Parliament, just pressing ahead with a referendum and letting it run through the courts. If it's deemed illegal, drop it, but it should fight through the courts. And she has had some success in this area. She was behind the prorogation legal challenge that ended up with the Supreme Court finding that it was illegal to prorogue Parliament. So, you know, she has reason to be confident going down that route. Angus McNeill just wants a plan B, and Angus likes to... likes to shout about things from the backbenches and start some trouble, which is mainly what he's doing at the moment.
James, how much thought is going inside the Westminster government into the question of the union and stopping Scotland drifting away as a result of Brexit?
I think you could see. I think you could see during the election that it's a really important issue. Looking at the actions and some of the things that the Prime Minister said, that they, you know, whether even with Theresa May, to be fair, you know, it's taken very seriously. It's taken very personally for Prime Ministers. You know, the idea of keeping that precious union, is the phrase that everybody will use, keeping that together. I also think if you will note that there's definitely a push in government to really look outside of Westminster, whether that's Scotland, whether that's Wales, or the North, as people in London seem to call
the fifth country in the UK.
As if I grew up in a different country in the Midlands. But although sometimes it does feel like it. But I think there's a push to look outside Westminster to try and think about what's needed, whether it be for Scotland or whether it be for the north of England or the Midlands, what's needed in terms of, I read your piece this morning on buses, and you made the valid point that too often, too much policy is formed by people whose only worldview is London.
Yeah.
And I definitely think the Prime Minister has talked about kind of levelling up. It's a very important thing to him. It was all throughout the election. And Dom, and I think you've got a Downing Street with various people in there that probably has more people, I don't know the stats on this, but feels like it has more people who are thinking about or from outside London than at many times before. You know, they're not, you've got a lot of people in government as advisors now who are not your typical special advisors through CCHQ, etc.
What do you think about this, Esther? Because, I mean, it's just a sort of, if in doubt, there's always a story somewhere that Nicola Sturgeon has gasped for another referendum.
Yeah, I mean, that's the...
And Boris Johnson just seems determined to say no.
Yeah, I mean, we saw, was it last week, that there was some polling numbers showing yes in the lead again. But I wonder if that's a bit kind of over-ambitious at the moment in terms of people's bullishness in the SNP, because surely, if anything, over the past couple of years, we've seen how horrendous the experience of trying to hold a referendum and then implement it can be. And we've also seen how difficult it can be for a small country to break away from a larger
block. Is that having cut through, Keir, if you were sitting in Scotland and you were in favour of independence, might you look at how complicated Britain taking itself out of the EU is and think, it would be nice if we could throw a switch, but it turns out it's quite difficult breaking up
There's probably a sweet spot that Brexit needs to land in, which is just bad enough that a group of people in Scotland and the SNP are very much targeting the former soft no voters, middle class Remainers being the strident point, and they're the people who have switched from no to yes largely. So Brexit needs to be bad enough to convince them, yes, let's do independence, but Brexit can't be so bad that they go, actually, hold on, yeah, this is a terrible idea. And we have seen movement both ways in the polling that shows that Remainers are switching from no to yes, but also there are Leave yes voters who at the moment are switching the other way and saying, well, hold on, why do we want to get rid of one union to join another one and, for example, give up fishing rights?
Exactly. That was, I was going to ask you, Kieran. I mean, number one, you talked about the record up there, and if you look at some of the stats that come out of the out of Scotland on the SNP's record, they're pretty terrible. I mean, we know, we've seen the Andrew Neil clip with Nicola Sturgeon and so on, holding her to account on those. Yet you don't seem to see that much movement in the polls. So I wanted to ask you, if Ruth was still there, Ruth Davidson was still there, might we see more inroads? And secondly, if they put so much stock into the EU option, you know, part of the reason we're going to leave is to join the EU, surely you're guaranteed to lose a decent swathe of independence voters who don't want to be just joined to Brussels.
Yeah, on the Ruth Davidson question, certainly what you would have if you had Ruth Davidson as leader of the Scottish Conservatives would be a credible alternative First Minister. Whether it would be enough to push the Tories high enough in the polls in Scotland is debatable. It would need to be the best day of their lives and some disaster to hit the SNP for the Tories to outpoll them. But it would be a possibility, you know, however slim, it would be a possibility. That's not the case now. The Scottish Tories currently don't have a leader. We'll see how Jackson Carlock or Michelle Ballantyne get on.
Who's your money on?
Jackson Carlow is certainly the favourite. He was Ruth Davidson's deputy. He is backed by almost every Tory parliamentarian in Scotland. But it seems a bit closer. Michelle Ballantyne has kicked off a kind of anti-establishment campaign, said the election result in Scotland was poor. We lost half our MPs. We need to do something different. And, you know, she was a Brexiteer. She was a Boris Johnson supporter early doors when people weren't in Scotland. And there's a bit of nervousness in the Carlow camp. So it will be closer than you might think. But if Jackson Carlow can't win it, he should be really asking himself why, when almost all of the machine is ostensibly behind him. He's still interim leader. He's fighting a leadership contest as leader. Right. You'd asked about public services as well. We're sitting here today where, as I said, we've got one hospital in Scotland where they've brought in two outside experts because of 80 infection-related incidents that have happened there. A flagship hospital commissioned under the SNP in Glasgow where a child has died and it's been linked to a hospital-acquired infection. You've got a sick kids hospital in Edinburgh which still hasn't opened because of problems with the build, the issues with the education service. At the moment, the Queensferry crossing, which connects Edinburgh to Fife in the north of Scotland, is closed because it's icy in Scotland.
I'm sure the bridge from Scotland to Northern Ireland will have no problems like that. And we should, because you mentioned it in your intro, we should just touch on Dirk Mackay briefly as well, a man that many people might not have heard of previously, but have heard of now, but for the wrong reasons.
Yes, Dermot Mackay was seen in many quarters as the favourite to succeed Nicola Sturgeon as First Minister. He had risen through the ranks of the SNP very quickly, and he was caught. He sent 270 messages on Instagram and Facebook to a 16-year-old schoolboy. These were given to the Sun, and obviously he resigned from government on the eve of the budget, and now his future as an MSP is under question, understandably. The problem this causes internally for the SNP is the succession planning.
Well, I was about to ask you that because I was sort of dimly aware of him, but only realised that he was seen as the obvious successor while reading the stories about why he was resigning. So who, if Nicola Sturgeon were to fall into the proverbial bus, who is there in the next ranks? Or maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe people thought the same thing when Alex Salmond stood down, that she could never match him, and yet she's exceeded him.
Yeah, well, Nicola Sturgeon was always seen as a successor. That was part of the process, you know. She was the protege. It's difficult. In Holyrood, there's only really John Swinney, who was leader before and as deputy first minister, who is an obvious safe pair of hands. What might be vital is, ahead of the next Holyrood election, is the Edinburgh Central SNP membership, which sounds like a very small electorate, but they might have to choose between Angus Robertson, the former Westminster leader, and Joanna Cherry, who we mentioned before, as their candidate for Holyrood 2021, which is the next Scottish parliamentary elections. Whoever wins that would be the obvious successor to Nicola Sturgeon.
I feel like we're learning a lot today. Coming up, well, let's talk about John Bercow and find out what we can learn about him that we haven't already heard a million times before. We'll be back after the break.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, Welcome back. You're listening to the Red Box podcast with me, Matt Jolly, joined in the studio by James Starkey, Kieran Andrews, and this is Esther Webber.
Anyone who imagined we'd be seeing less of John Bercow now that he's quit the Speaker's chair will be sorely disappointed. He's responded to the accusations in the press of bullying, which he denies, by popping up on every radio and TV outlet possible. Nothing to do, of course, with the fact that his memoirs have just come out, which he has used to take pot shots at almost everyone he used to work with, including clerks and parliamentary staff.
How lovely it is to see him back on the TV. And the thing that strikes me, Esther, listening to the various interviews that John Bercow is doing, remember, only to plug his book, is how he thinks in his mind, he's dispelling the idea of him being a pompous, arrogant, overbearing, oily, irritant who looked down on everyone around him. And yet in every interview, he just reinforces this impression.
It's really quite, I found it quite revelatory. It's like, I always thought before this that the kind of caricature of him in the press was a bit overdone, possibly, and that he can actually be like that, be this kind of tendency towards the self-aggrandizing, shall we say. But it's actually worse than I thought. And every interview has kind of played into that. And even the book, which I have read parts of, not in full, but just giving...
You have to keep having a shower with you in between chapters.
Well, just skimming through, I happened upon a piece where he referred to one of his early speeches as an MP as being typical of the Bercow style. And it's this kind of thing that really kind of plays into his critics' hands, even if we leave aside the allegations that have been made against him.
What's the view inside government of John Bercow, James?
Well, I think...
You're not there anymore, he's not there anymore, so you can finally tell us
the
truth.
As someone who worked on the Vote Leave campaign, I would say I'm probably a bit biased against him. Definitely.
Bias is all the rage now, apparently. It's like you're fine to... He was, so...
Exactly, it's fine to be biased. I think he wasn't viewed positively. As Esther said, self-awareness is clearly not a strong point of Bercow. You know, this whole point about, well, I should have a peerage because everyone else has... Number one... You know, if I'm just a general member of the public, if your reason for having the peerage is anyone else that's done my job before has got it, you're slightly out of touch, I would suggest. I think, you know, that's just one of the things that shows how out of touch
he is.
But
there is also something very funny about him in particular complaining about centuries-old traditions not being
exactly.
Respected.
Well, I can't remember the quote he had, but, you know, we'll never make progress if we always stick on convention or something akin to that. And now he's citing convention as a reason for him having a peerage. I think the truth is they went through that parliamentary process. I don't think it would be a surprise to say, you know, I 100% agreed with what the Prime Minister said about the last parliament. It needed to be... It was going nowhere. I mean, if they'd have managed to block Brexit, at least they would have done something.
Yeah.
At least there would have been a point in it. The problem with the last parliament, and he assisted them, was they just never made a decision. And they wondered why... Sorry if this sounds like a rant, but they wondered why people came back and gave the Prime Minister such a large majority.
He basically was the ref who kept on trying to give one side an advantage.
Yeah, and
they never came close to scoring.
And I think related to that, it's like when we did various stories about him upending precedent and about the bullying allegations, he had this wave of defenders, mainly from the Remain side. And I think he's reached the point where he's even scared them off. Like, they're not coming out in the same way for him now. And you just feel that even if he kept a lid on it slightly more, he'd have more of a case.
Yeah, no, I think
it's gone too far the other way.
And it's sort of amazing, Kieran, even in some of the extracts of his book, which I'm not going to tell you what it's called because I don't want anyone to buy it, but if... He sort of challenges the idea that he was biased and actually insisted he treated everyone fairly. And then there's these sort of pen portraits of David Cameron and Boris Johnson and Theresa May, all of which are vicious and gratuitous. I mean, I'm not averse to being gratuitously rude about some of our political leaders, but the sort of vitriol that he piles on them, while also then heaping praise on people like, I think it's quite nice about Jeremy Corbyn and Gordon Brown. It's the lack of self-aware, like it's so much more self-revelatory than he thinks. It's essentially like Alan Partridge's memoirs.
Except a lot smaller.
Yes.
it's a fascinating thing, and I was always watching this from afar, so glued to, I'm not saying that proceedings at the Scottish Parliament weren't fascinating, but I spent a lot of time watching what was going on at Westminster, and watching John Bercow in the chair, you could see it seeping through. And the idea that, like you say, you can write your book and say, oh no, listen, I ran everything down the line, but all of them, no, hated them, awful, terrible human beings. These people were great. Obviously, I never let my personal feelings get in the way. It just so happens that every knife-edge decision I made went in the way of the people I've said I quite like.
And just quickly, Esther, on the question of the bullying allegations, there's sort of two things happening this week. One is the decision being made on who does and doesn't get a peerage, potentially. And the other is the changing of the rules of how bullying allegations are going to be dealt with.
Yes, so the House of Lords Appointments Commission is meeting this week. And I think we understand it's all but guaranteed that he won't get a peerage, simply because they're not in the business of recommending peerages for people who are under investigation by regulators, as he is. And the other significant thing that's happening this week is the sort of management body of the House of Commons, which is called the Commons Commission, has finally come out in favour of a plan for taking MPs out of their own complaints system, which is very important because still at this point, MPs have the final say on what happens to any of their colleagues who are accused of treating people badly.
This move is described as both sort of seismic and sort of depressing that it's even not the case already. James.
One of the other things about Bercow that should be pointed out is we don't know the validity of the allegations that are made against him, but it was him that prevented himself from being investigated. So if he had allowed himself to be investigated in Parliament, this would have been done and dusted. No one could level these accusations at him now and prevent this peerage, because we would have had it all before. So the great irony of the reforms, which I think most people in Westminster that I know would say are massively welcome. I mean, HR is something that has not particularly moved quickly in Westminster, I would argue. The irony is, it's his own hold-up on this process that has meant he now may not get a peerage, certainly at this time of asking.
Well, it'll be very sad for him. And I'm glad we've sorted that out. So no big reshuffle this week. No obvious successor to Nicola Sturgeon. And hilariously, no peerage for John Bercow. Well, on that happy note, that's all we've got time for this week. My massive thanks to James Starkey, Esther Webber and Kieran Andrews. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Acast or wherever you listen, so you don't miss future episodes. And sign up to the morning email that Esther and I do, Redbox. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.